We're kind of getting right down to the end of our series of lessons on 1 Peter. Now tonight we're looking at how God defines a Christian. And 1 Peter chapter 4, we're actually going to look at a few things that are found in verses 12 through 19. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. But rejoice, inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that, when his glory shall be revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy. If you be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are you, for the Spirit of glory and of God resteth upon you. On their part he is evil spoken of, but on your part he is glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, or as a thief, or as an evildoer, or as a busybody in other men's matters. Yet if any man suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God on this behalf. For the time is come, the judgment must begin at the house of God. And if it first begin at us, what shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel of God? And if the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing, as unto a faithful Creator. I'm sure that you have noticed how Christian is just so freely tossed about. It kind of sometimes raises a few problems and other things. And, you know, you hear about Christian schools and Christian music and Christian bookstores and so on and so on it goes. You know what I mean by this. It's kind of loosely applied. And then we hear of what I've always called as hyphenated Christians. In other words, there's those that are Baptist Christians, Methodist hyphen Christians, and even Catholic Christian might be heard. Now, all that withstanding, that's what we hear. That's what goes on. I mean, I don't think that's a surprise to anybody. But when we go over here and look at the Scriptures, all we find in the Scriptures that are Christians are disciples of Jesus Christ. And you find it mentioned, the word, only three times in all the New Testament. There's the one in Acts chapter 11, verse 26, where the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. Then there's in Acts chapter 26, and verse 28, where Agrippa says, "Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian." And kind of interesting there that he would come up with that. And then there's this in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 16, where Peter writes about this. Now, Acts chapter 11 and verse 26 is interesting, where it says, "The disciples were called Christians first in Antioch." Made mention, we were talking about that a little bit in class. But the word "first" there means they were called Christians first here, but that would continue after this event, which we see that it did. But this idea that they were called Christians first, the word "called" there is kind of a unique word, the Greek word that's used. There's I guess you could say, a more common word that's used in just a lot of cases, and it's kaleo. But that's not the word that's used here. The word that's used here is this unique word. It's a krematizo. And it really indicates something given by divine appointment, which would mean that, well, what's happening here is not something that's, you know, common. And what happens here in Acts chapter 11 and verse 26 is actually a fulfillment of a prophecy in the Old Testament. That's back in Isaiah chapter 62 and verse 2, where it says, "And the Gentiles shall see thy righteousness." You know, this takes place in Antioch. I mean, this takes place in Gentile territory. "And all kings are going to see your glory. And you shall be called by a new name." New name, not used before. Well, Christians wasn't used before until they were called Christians first at Antioch. A new name. And they were called this name. And as I said, the word there in the New Testament, called, means by divine appointment. When you look at the rest of Isaiah 62, too, "which the mouth of the Lord shall name." So there it is in Isaiah 62, 2. There's the prophecy. The fulfillment is over here in Acts chapter 11 and verse 26. So it's something that's important. And even though it's not the term that's used the most to describe the followers of Jesus, not in the New Testament, that word would be disciple, which far exceeds all other words. And of course, next to that would have been would be saints. But Christian is a special title to wear, and because the Christian's thrown around so loosely anymore, without any regard for it or thinking anything about it, I think it kind of has a tendency to lessen or cheapen how important that is to be called a Christian. And so what we ought to do is not look at how the world defines it, but we should probably look at this. I mean, I really think this now. There are times whenever it's absolutely alarming at what is called or who is called Christian, and how some people view themselves with what they do and other things like that, and then will just, you know, go ahead and call themselves Christians there. And then, I mean, they're just far removed from anything in the scriptures, but then I guess they don't think that matters much. But I think here in 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 12 through 19, we see some things that tell us how God defines a Christian. Now, however God defines a Christian would certainly be better than how Noah Webster would define a Christian or any other dictionary that you could think of, or the Oxford Dictionary, whatever there is. So let's look at a few of these. And of course, we're not going to look at all of them, but we're just going to look at some of them. First of all, I want to suggest to you that when you look at verses 12 through 15, he's describing someone here. A Christian is someone who's willing to pay the price. That's what you see. It talks a lot about the one who will suffer. And the suffering that's done there is because Christ suffered, be expected to suffer. But if you suffer as a follower of Jesus, that you ought to be glad to do this, and happy are you if you're reproached for the name of Christ in verse 14, etc., etc. But now, what this is telling us, I think, dovetails in with something that Jesus said in Matthew chapter 16 and in verse 26. In Matthew chapter 16 and verse 26, it says, "For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" And so what we have here is that there's a price. And Christians are not willing to give up their soul. Christians are willing to, as far as it goes, to, you know, bear a cross if that's what's necessary, to suffer whatever that might be. We're not going to give up our soul, our salvation for anything. So we're willing to do this, and actually, you know, people bring about suffering and other things like that, hoping to get someone to denounce being a Christian. But that's not what we're going to do. Now, while we do that kind of thing, and we willingly, you know, stay our ground, don't back up on that, that is not something that has to be overt. I've known a couple of people who actually thought that it was okay to behave in such a way to invite dislike or things, you know, where you're gonna suffer some abuse. They thought that was just the thing to do, and it would just say, oh well, you know, if people speak well of you, that's something that's wrong. It was odd, all I could say, to go about doing that. But that's not the idea at all. And one of the things that you find, if you look at 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12, it says, all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. I always thought that was just something that went with the territory. It's something that may happen. You know, if you'll be a Christian and just behave like a Christian's supposed to behave, you know, you'll live as a Christian, you'll be a Christian, you'll act like a Christian, there's going to be plenty of people that are going to give you grief. You don't have to go out here and try to seek it. And I just think that's just the wrong thing for some to do. And then you think about what happened when you look through the book of Acts. I think there are some examples of individuals who were suffering for the cause of Christ, and yet I don't see any place in there where they were just seeking it out. You know, you look at the apostles in Acts chapter 4 and 5. In both of those cases, the council was coming down, the Jewish council was coming down on them plenty hard, wanting them to stop filling up Jerusalem with your doctrine. It's one of the things that they asked them, demanded of them. And they wouldn't do that, and they end up being thrown into jail and you know, brought before the ruling powers and other things like that, and they just kept right on going. And you know, those people that you told not to be out there preaching anymore, well, they got out of the hold, and they're out there and they're doing it again. And so they were not doing that just to be persecuted. It was something that happened. How about another character? You go forward in the book of Acts just a little bit. Don't we run across a man by the name of Stephen? And Stephen, you would say, well, look at that. You know what Stephen did? That's a sermon that's there. I'm surprised sometimes, you know, we talk about, well, here's the Sermon on the Mount, and here's Paul's sermon at Athens and other things, but Stephen somehow or another gets overlooked as this being a sermon. Now, I understand that it was largely a history lesson. He gave the Jews just a short synopsis, you might say, of their history. And here's the thing, you know, when you're talking about that, they didn't have a whole lot of problem with that. Why, they were with him on that. They thought that everything that he had to say, we know, was right up to par. There had been complete and total agreement. It wasn't until he changed the subject and started talking about Jesus, that's when things really went off the rails. And he didn't do that just to invite that. You can tell by him going through that history lesson, he was bringing it all along through history, right up to current time, and now I'm going to tell you about Jesus. That's what he was doing. And when that happened, well, we know how that ended up, don't we, for Stephen. And then, after this, you go into the next chapter, and then there's a man by the name of Saul of Tarsus. And he's full of zeal. He admits that. Zeal that was misplaced. He says in his own writing that he was exceedingly angry. It just almost to the point of insanity. But he was persecuting the church, hailing men and women, dragging them off to prison. And if you're thrown in there, generally you didn't come out alive. But that starts in Acts chapter 8, continues over a little bit into Acts chapter 9. So a Christian is one who's willing to pay the price. That's what they did. And that would be how God would define a Christian. He doesn't back up, doesn't quit, stays with it. Have you ever noticed sometimes? Yeah, you know, I think, you know, if I've been a Christian, I haven't been a Christian as long as some folks that are here tonight, but I've been in a lot of different places and met a lot of different people. And I've met a lot of people. And it really didn't take much to get them to quit. I'm not kidding you now. I mean, and some of the things that people have quit over has just always been astonishing to me. Because of the greeting they got when they got in the building, and somehow or another, well, it's just more than I could bear, you know. And I've got to quit over this or that or the other, or over the songs that we're singing, or any number of things. People will just quit for the slightest thing. The faith that they have must be held by the slenderest thread that just breaks like that. It's amazing. And you look at these people in New Testament times, and you see what they encountered, what they dealt with, what was done to them, and you see them persevering through all that. It really makes you think. Well, our second point is God would define a Christian as one who has ethical guidelines. He has ethical guidelines. Now, let me hasten to say, not only does he have ethical guidelines, but he follows them. That's there in verse 15 of 1 Peter. Let me get back here. We'll read that again. Kind of refresh our memory about it. Now, while there's suffering going on, and if you suffer for being a Christian, which is a good thing, don't let any of you suffer as a murderer or as a thief or as an evildoer or as a busybody in other men's matters. I believe the American Standard Version has a meddler in other men's matters. That probably is a little bit harder to think about. You know, you stop and you look at that and you think, well, now, you know, Christians being murderers and thieves and evildoers and meddlers and other... Well, it happens. I have a friend that preaches down in Cincinnati. There's a member of the church there, whole family, had a daughter, a son, and the daughter was dating some young man that didn't quite come up to the family standards. Whether that was good or bad, I'm not in a position to say. But they really wanted this to break up. This daughter, sister of the boy, and this boyfriend. They did everything they could to try and break this up. Tried to reason with the girl. Ran the boy off I don't know how many times. Nothing would work. Just couldn't run him off. So the dad and the son decided one day that they would just take matters into their own hands, and they met him at this run-down shopping center and in the parking lot. And this was going to be it. And when he said that he refused to see this girl anymore, they just killed him. That's two members of the church. It's murder. Well, they went to trial. They were convicted. I don't know if they're still in prison or not. Now, don't tell me Christians can't do something like this. How about be a thief? I know a Christian that embezzled close to a quarter. It was $200,000, but it was probably more than that. It was probably well over a quarter of $1 million. A Christian. Good family. Went to jail over it. Evildoer. I think we've already talked about some evil, but whatever else there might be. But maybe the easiest one is this meddler in other men's matters. Now, I've always thought that this was something where somebody just gets involved too much where they really shouldn't. They really shouldn't be. There ought to come a point where, you know, you leave this alone in somebody's personal business. Leave it alone. Now, unless it becomes something full-blown and major and affects the church or brings reproach to the church and other things, that's different. But there are some matters where, well, you know, we just don't need to weigh in on that. Because when we do, we can become a meddler in other men's matters. And a lot of times, when the problem reaches the stage of this and someone begins meddling, it's not so much that they want the other person to do what the scriptures say. They want the other person to do what I say. And I want you to do it the way I want to do it. And that's where the problem might be. Now, there's fine to have questions and to show interest and concern and all that. I understand that. But, you know, there still is a line there. And, you know, be careful that, you know, we don't cross that line. Now, when we talk about that, or just any kind of guidelines anymore, it just doesn't seem like there's any ethical guidelines anymore. You know? You look around and you think, how in the world are people doing these kinds of things and just acting as though it's just, you know, no consequence to it. It's just without even thinking. Well, I think Romans chapter 1 and verse 28 speaks to this. And the very first part of it, where it says that even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. Now, that's right here in the midst of a whole lot of problem where people get involved in sin and they deny God and they begin this downward spiral into sin where it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. But it's got a starting point, and that is they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. What kind of ethical guideline have they got? Well, if they don't have the guidelines that God gives, I don't think they've got much when it comes to the matter of ethics. And if they would have some, it would come more by accident than by design. But now we do find, back in 1 Peter, this time, look back at chapter 2. We'll back up a little bit. We've gone over this before. But 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 20 says, "For what glory is it when you be buffeted for your faults, you shall take it patiently. But if, when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently. This is acceptable with God." So what's this telling us? It's telling us some do suffer for wrong and some even suffer for doing right. But whatever the case might be, you take it patiently. But what he's saying in verse 15 is, don't suffer for wrong. Don't do this for wrongdoing. Whatever you do, don't do that. And there's a reason for this. Back here in Romans chapter 2 and verses 23 and 24, there's something there that sheds a little bit of light on this. He says, "Thou that makest thy boast of the law, through breaking the law, dishonorest thou God." Oh, so here it is. So great, you know, exposés and explanations of the law and everything like that. And you know, you're right. You're 100% on that. But you're not practicing it. There's a problem there, see? And what is that problem? Well, look at verse 24. That the name of God then, because of this, is blasphemed among the Gentiles through you, as it is written. You know, I think back to the time of David and the business with Bathsheba. And one of the things that Nathan says is that by your actions as the king and doing this business here and everything that's gone on, you and her and then Uriah and having him killed and all these other things, he says, you've given the enemies of the Lord an opportunity to blaspheme. Well, that's right. So if Christians go out here and they become murderers or thieves or evildoers or meddlers in other men's mouths, well, we don't want to, you know. No. No, there'll be people that, oh, well, that Church of Christ over there, you know. You know what happened over there? Well, they had a couple people kill somebody. Some boyfriend of their daughter, and they met him in a parking lot and they killed him. That's not going to bring a lot of praise from folks out there in the world. And they'll be eager to tear down the Lord's people and, of course, the Lord. So it's something that's a serious matter. It brings reproach. So Christians should have ethical guidelines, and to have ethical guidelines, you follow Christ. That's what you follow. Not the world, not how things are done in the world and other things, or how they've ever been done, and you'll forget all of that. But Matthew chapter 9 and verse 9, when Matthew was called from his collection table, Jesus said, follow me. Follow me. And then Paul later writes that he says to the Corinthians, now you be a follower of Christ or an imitator of Christ as I imitate Christ. That's what we should do. So there's where our guidelines ought to be. They ought to rest in Jesus Christ. Now also God defines a Christian as one who would be in God's family. The church is God's family. In 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 15, he's writing to tell them how they ought to behave themselves in the house of God, the household of God, the church of God, which is the pillar and the ground of the truth, and other things along like that. The church is God's family. Romans chapter 8 this time, and if we take a look at we'll look at verse 15. There's a couple of passages here. The first one is verse 15. It says, you have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption, whereby we cry, Abba, Father. So we are adopted as children into this family. But the interesting thing is, even though we might be adopted as children, we find ourselves described in verse 17, if children, then heirs of God, and watch now, joint heirs with Christ. If so be that we suffer with him, we will also be glorified together. So part of God's family? Yes. Adopted as children? Yes. But that doesn't mean something lesser, because we find in the same context that we are joint heirs with Jesus. So there's the advantage of something else of a Christian and a definition. Someone who's in God's family and acts like they're in God's family. They know how to, as it says in 1 Timothy chapter 3, to behave oneself in God's family. And that doesn't mean, you know, when we're in the church house, it means all the time. We're in God's family all the time. It would be 24/7, and we ought to act accordingly. Now also in verse 17, there's a question that's asked at the end of 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 17. What talks about the judgment that's going to come and says, well, now if it first begins at us, and here comes the question, what shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel of God? Well, this is telling us that God's definition of a Christian is somebody who has obeyed the gospel. Verse 17. And what is that about obeying the gospel? Well, I'd like for you to look at a couple of citations here in the book of Acts. How about Acts chapter 8? Philip meets up with a man from Ethiopia. He's treasurer there in Ethiopia. He's traveling along. He's reading from the book of Isaiah. And when Philip encounters him, he just asks him about it. Do you understand what you're reading? And he says, well, essentially he says, no. He says, I'm having a little trouble. How can I unless someone guide me? I need a little help. And so what does Philip do? Well, Philip comes up there, sits with him, goes over where he's reading in Isaiah. And then starting in verse 35, Philip opened his mouth and beginning at the same scripture, and he preached unto him Jesus. And as they went on their way, they came unto a certain water. And the eunuch said, see, that would be the treasurer, the eunuch. Here is water. What doth hinder me to be baptized? Philip said, if you believe with all your heart, you may. And he answered and said, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And he, that'd be the Ethiopian, commanded the chariot, stand still. They, the Ethiopian and Philip, went down both into the water, both Philip and the eunuch, and he, Philip, baptized him, the eunuch. There's an example there of someone who has obeyed the gospel. A lot of people think that they have obeyed the gospel or that they're Christians or they've done whatever God would say for them to do, and then you find out, well, they really haven't. But now here's the man here. He heard about Jesus. You can see evidence here that he believed about Jesus. Also, he was willing to confess his faith in Jesus, and he was baptized. There you go. Now, as the story goes on, it moves from Philip, it moves some to kind of a mixture there for a little bit of Saul of Tarsus, or Paul, and Peter. And then it goes back to Paul again. Pretty well stays with him through the last half of the book of Acts. And you get to Acts chapter 18. And Paul's gone in up at the northeast edge of almost we would call Greece. One time it was different. You remember the old country of Yugoslavia, that was all broke up. Macedonia reappeared. And so on, but they enter in up there. And then he proceeds south, down the peninsula. Berea, Thessalonica, Athens, other places. He winds up at Corinth. And when he's there at Corinth, he just goes like he's always done. He goes it says in Acts chapter 18, verse 4, he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath. That's what he did. He went to where there were people that already believed in God. Good place to start. I don't think he did that all the time and just went to those folks, but that was something that he always seemed like his starting point. But you see that he made some progress. Verse 7 tells us, with the Jews in the synagogue, even to Crispus in verse 8, the chief ruler of the synagogue. That's really, really something there. But then at the last part of verse 8, it says that many of the Corinthians, now that would include just whoever, not just the Jews in the synagogues, but whatever. Many of the Corinthians hearing, believed, and were baptized. So God defines a Christian as someone who has obeyed the gospel in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 17, like the eunuch did and like those at Corinth did. Yeah. And people can do the same thing today? Yeah, People can do the same thing today. Obey the gospel the very same way. And this is something that's important to do. Now, one more passage and the lesson is yours. And that passage is in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 18. It says, "If the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear?" Sobering words. Where will we be? Where are we now? Well, if we're a part of that ungodly and sinner, we ought to do something about it. And even though the righteous scarcely be saved, they have a chance. If we're sinners and ungodly, we don't have any chance. So what we should do, we also then should obey the gospel of Jesus Christ like it was done in New Testament times. If we can assist you in doing that, or to explain what needs to be done, we'd be happy to do so. If you need to return to the paths of righteousness, we'd be happy to help you with that as well. Whatever the case might be, if you're subject to the gospel invitation, why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.